And I think when you look at the slabs in that show that I just did recently, you know, a lot of the clay is just raw coming through. A lot of it's just black underglaze wash in the to accentuate the drawing marks in the clay itself. Little dashes of color here to again like accentuate certain areas. So very little glaze work at all on any of those.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and I'm going to introduce you today to the great Chris Ricardo. Chris is a sculptor working out of Helena, Montana in the United States, and he does really beautiful work that has an edge to it. He says that his sculptures are a direct physical manifestation of his inner thoughts and his moral struggles. He says they are essentially frozen moments in time that are ripped from the ongoing struggle that takes place in his mind between good and evil and right and wrong. We had a delightful conversation about his journey in clay, from bronze to ceramics, his involvement with community, and of course we talked a lot about surface design. I really hope you enjoy this session today. Please leave us a review and subscribe to the show to help others find the podcast.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Chris, thanks so much for spending some time with us today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. Really super glad that you're here.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me to do this, and I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Of course, I really like your work. There's a dark quality, I think, that you've referenced in your work, and I really like that. And of course, I love the color and the relation to form. I know in some of my work, I've had emotional reactions to some of the work that I've done that has sort of a clown quality. And I think yours has a similar, very different, but a similar kind of angle. And I bet you get quite emotional reactions to your work as well.
Oh, I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, I know you've been sculpting for a long time, and you know, your work obviously represents years of hard work. Can you tell our audience a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. I went to college. I graduated in 1990. I went to Boston University, the College of Fine Arts. And I studied very classically, like the figure. So it was all like, you know, about the figure and anatomy. So it was very tight, realism. And so everything was, you know, kind of classical training. And I did very little ceramic work. Everything was, you know, life size. And the clay was just the ways of getting, you know, that original piece done. And then everything was mold making and casting. So it was very classical. And I did maybe one ceramic class. So ceramics wasn't something that it came years later, like 20 years later.
Oh, wow.
So I was late to ceramics. And then when I graduated college with my big degree in sculpture, not knowing what I was going to do, I went to the foundries because I needed to work. Yeah. And so I figured, well, I'll learn how to cast, and I will at least have a way to cast my work, which again was mostly figurative, but I was starting to get into the kind of style that you see in my ceramic work, that loose kind of gestural style. Mm-hmm. But it was still somewhat representational and figurative, very little narrative to it. It was just kind of straightforward figurative. But again, it was all cast into bronze or some other material. So ceramic, again, it wasn't something I was doing. very little color. It was all traditional bronze coloring, patinas. So I was a bronze worker for 20 some odd years. And I had a foundry to try and make a living and support my family. And, you know, so again, I guess going fast forwarding to probably in the 2000s, I was working at a place called the Armory Arts Center in West Palm. And I was running kind of this sculpture ceramic department and still running a foundry. And we had a fundraiser to raise money for the ceramic department, sculpture department, foundry areas. And we were making this Mad Hatter's Tea Party fundraiser, and we were making teapots. And so I said, well, I can't have time to make a bronze teapot. So I said, well, I'll sculpt a little clay teapot. And it ended up going into the Sunny Cam Teapot Museum. And I said, boy, this was kind of fun to do. And it was outside of my wheelhouse. And I was running that residency program down there. So I was surrounded by a bunch of young ceramic artists that I knew very well. And I said, you know, and I was getting older, and I said, you know, like, this ceramic thing is kind of way more fun than the bronze. And it was easier and less, you know, less danger involved in this. And that's where I started. It was like a whole new, you know, career for me. And that was it. I veered away from bronze almost completely within about a year.
Wow.
It just completely changed my outlook on my work. I could start to tell stories more. And there was a few pieces that if you look back, you can see I went to my first Nsika. And so everything was new, and it was like this whole new career and shifting. And it was a really exciting time for me. And that was it. Bronze stopped almost immediately. I was still running the foundry, but I stopped casting my work almost immediately. And doing these one-off pieces in ceramic. So, and I was learning from my residents at that time. And then I went to the Bray, to Archie Bray in 2012. And that was it. I was done. Foundries, that was it. No more foundry work, no more casting in bronze.
You were hooked.
And that's how I ended up in ceramics to where I am today. So, yeah, it was kind of a weird way of coming to ceramics, but really happy I did end up here.
Yeah. Very refreshing, I bet, to be able to shift from one style of creative work to another.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't get that technical, you know, I didn't get the technical piece of ceramics. You know, so I was behind, I think, in some ways, you know, the chemistry of it. But again, I was surrounded by so many great, you know, the ceramic community is so giving, and so I picked it up as I went. But I think, again, being at that age where I was, you know, when I went to the Bray, I was in my 30s. So I was like the old man on campus, you know, and so it was a fun new, you know, it was like this great shot in the arm for me. It was, you know, I was already sculpting. I've been sculpting for so many years. But all these new techniques and color was a huge piece for me. Mm-hmm. You know, bronzing, it was just, you know, patina is a limited thing in bronze.
Yeah.
So that was a big part for me, was, wow, here's this glaze formulation, and color became this whole new thing for me. I could tell stories with glaze and color and not just the sculpting piece of this. So yeah, it was a whole, you know, that's why I don't, you know, bronze was not even a thought for me anymore. So yeah, exciting.
Really very
exciting.
Cool. And what are you doing now? You're in Montana, right?
So we came up, I did my first residency at the Bray. So we were in Florida, came out here in 2012 to do my summer residency in Montana for 3 months. And then in 2014, I loved it. I knew I was hooked in ceramics and loved Helena. In 14, I had an opportunity to come out here with Beth Kavaner, who was a good friend of mine. She was going to build a studio, She said, what do you think? You know, would you want to commit on that? And so we moved the whole family out west and started that Studio 740. And then I ended up getting a 2-year at the Bray. And then I also ended up working at the Holter Museum and then ended up becoming the executive director of that museum. So I was doing so many things. And so, yeah, so we ended up moving here full time, which we love, Helena. So it's been a crazy, but almost 10 years, I think now, but
yeah.
And now we're to all another Omerta Arts, which is my new studio. And so it's been crazy.
Very good. Very good. So yeah. You got lots on the go.
No, it's so much, so much.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, you know, I'm really interested in, I'll call it inspiration and what inspires artists. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what's inspiring you today. What gets you out of bed in the morning?
You know, I think, it gets a little bit tougher as I've gotten older, but you know, I think when I was running the museum a few years back, it got tough. You know, COVID was tough. You know, when I was the AD of the museum, I wasn't making a lot of work, you know, and there was some stressful periods in my life. And so the work kind of got difficult for me. And I wasn't, you know, when I was younger, the ideas, there was so much in my head and there was too much. I could make work without even thinking about it. You know what I mean? There was so much imagery and ideas and thoughts. And, but as I was running a business and running the museum and I had people to worry about and my family and my employees, and it became very difficult to really work. And I wasn't, you know, there was a lapse of about 4 or 5 years where I wasn't making work. And that's part of the reason that I left the museum was because I couldn't focus and I was losing, you know, my career as a ceramic artist and as an artist. And I couldn't let that happen, you know, because I could feel it slipping away. And so when I left there a year and a half ago, and we started Omerta Arts, my new studio, I set the goal to start a show, which was called Slabs of Agony. And there's a whole story behind that title, but there was a series of small slabs and there were a lot of drawing on those, low relief, and they were mostly just portraits of, you know, not necessarily just specific people, but figures and faces, yep. And a lot of emotion in that. And I think, so that was me saying, okay, I'm going to start kind of from start over again, go back to basics. Yeah. And not think so hard about it, but just draw, you know, and just do what I love to do. And that's portraiture and people. And then start fresh and start thinking ahead of what's in the future. So right now I'm kind of thinking, where do I want to go? And I'm looking for inspiration now. And I'm surrounded by nature here in Montana. I mean, I've always done the figure, and the figure is what intrigues me the most. But I do have all this other stuff around me right now. So I'm in this weird, you know, spot right now where I'm really trying to think is what's next for me in this part of my life, you know, and starting this new business and the new studio. So it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot does inspire me, but I've got this new fresh start. And so that's a big question right now. You know, the figure is my main inspiration. And I'm looking for new ways to represent that. And so I'm experimenting a lot with how do I want to, my work is always, you know, as you've seen that I take liberties with proportion a lot. And so that's something I'm working on is where do I want to go with that. And then storytelling and narrative. And so I haven't done that in a long time. And so I get a lot of people saying, oh, I want to see more of what, you know, you've done in the past. And So yeah, I'm getting a lot of feedback right now. So I'm kind of taking a lot of that feedback and kind of processing that.
It's hard, isn't it? I mean, I hear you saying, gosh, you were basically a manager when you were at the gallery museum. And, and so that, because I've been in that role myself, I know that that can consume a person's energies and take away from that creative juices that that we want to drive for, right?
Yeah.
And so I hear you kind of saying, okay, I'm finished with that. I've started my own studio. Now, where do I get back? How do I get that knife edge on my creative stuff?
Yeah. Well, and I think too, you know, my work has, like you said, it's had a darkness to it. It's had an edge to it. Sexuality, you know, and a lot of that has depended on where I've shown, where I've been in the country, you know, the markets that I've been in. You know, Helena is a very different city. You know, I'm in Montana now, so I can't show certain things. And, you know, so I have to be careful about where I'm at and what I want to show. And, you know, if I'm showing work in a certain gallery in California, I can show certain things in certain places, in certain galleries. So, and that comes to making sales, making a living, you know, so I'm in this weird, again, situation where I have to decide, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I want to see some of the older erotic stuff you used to do. And, you know, but I want to see some newer stuff that's safer over here. So it's this weird, you know, spot that I have to kind of decide, and can I do it all, you know, to please everybody? And
yeah,
and do I want to do that? So yeah, it's this kind of fun spot to be in, but it's also tough. I want to do what I want to do, and
yeah, for sure, for sure,
you know, but I also want to make work that's accessible to everybody.
Yeah, you know, you want to do both. I think you want to be able to do what excites you and do what turns your cranks, my phrase, and also at the same time be able to sell it in the market that you're in, right? So
be nice, right? It'd be nice.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Now, are there specific artists or historical influences that have really affected your work and stimulated some of your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you look back, I mean, I think that my teachers, my professors in college were a huge influence on me. I started as a graphic design major because, you know, I was like, my father, who supported me 100%, was like, you need to make sure that, you know, this art thing, again, which he was very supportive of, but he's like, you need to make sure you can make a living at something. So make sure there's a backup. And so I went to Boston University because I could get a liberal arts training as well. And they said, well, the graphic design, you know, maybe I'll go into advertising and I can still do some art. But back in the 80s, 90s, you know, graphic design was not, we weren't into the computer thing so much yet. And it was just, you know, I was writing typeface and it was horrible. You know, and then I realized I wasn't going to get into advertising, and it was terrible. And so the sculpture teacher, Lloyd Lilly, who was a famous, you know, he did all the public sculpture in Boston. And he saw something in me, and they basically credited me my first, almost three quarters of my freshman year. I jumped ship on graphic design about three quarters of the way through my freshman year. And they gave me basically the credits for all that time to go into the sculpture department.
Cool.
So I was really lucky, but they really influenced my life and my trajectory, you know, in school. And then somebody said to me, and I hadn't really, you know, going through my childhood, and I drew a lot and I was very artistic, but I didn't look at a lot through art history. And then one of the professors said, you draw a lot like Giacometti, who I didn't really know much about. And then once I started looking, you know, that was it. I was like, wow, like this guy here, there's something about this. And so that was my main influence, you know, is how was he doing this? And I could see the similarities in how we drew. And then once I got my hands on clay, the way I handle it, and you can kind of see in my work now, there's this definite feeling that I, you know, that I have with him and his work and how he saw things. And so, yeah, so that's my biggest influence, I think. And again, and my professors, same thing. So, and I guess there's a lot. I look at a lot of abstract expressionist painting, which I think you can see in my work. So my work's very gestural and fluid and loose. And so I think that's what I look to in art around me.
Yeah, for sure. Like I look at your work and see a story. I see, the pieces coming to life in a way, in my mind. Well, now I know you're shifting your work, so this question might not fit, but what kind of meaning do you hope to convey to your customers, to people when they look at your work?
Yeah, when you look at the earlier ceramic work, you know, and again, I was brand new to me, you know, and the bronze work was my attempt at, you know, again, the classic training I had with the anatomy, and I was still holding true to the anatomy as best I could, but along, you know, again, the Giacometti elongations and like really playing with all that, and then it would shift through my career. And so it was always like this back and forth between holding true to the anatomy. And then sometimes I would really lose it, you know, but for me, it's that challenge of like trying to make a good head, you know, a good portrait. That's completely, you know, the anatomy is obliterated, but it's still there in some ways. There's still that foundation. And when I teach, you know, I'll teach my style, let's call it my style of anatomy. And I'll tell my students, like, this is completely wrong. Like, you know, this is not how you're supposed to teach anatomy, but it's fun. And we're going to go through this, but remember there is a structure to a head, and you've got to kind of understand it's there. And there's a reason why, you know, the eyes go here and there's a bone structure around them that hold them here. But we're going to use that to kind of exaggerate and create this expression that makes this portrait. So, you know, I think I find myself sometimes going back and getting tighter with the anatomy, but I'm going to probably go back into more narrative work. And I just started to figure the other day, you know, that was pretty, you know, the anatomy again was pretty grotesque, you know, and pretty blown out of proportion. But full figurative. So, you know, I don't know. I think I have an idea. I'm not sure, but it probably be fairly. I might take the narrative even further than I ever have, let's say. So fairly detailed storytelling. Beyond what I've ever done.
Cool.
So multiple figures, you know, more intricate storytelling. I think is what I'm planning on doing.
Have you got a sense of what story it is that you're trying to tell?
that's the big question. That's the big question. You know, I don't. That's something that, you know, I've never been political in my work. I've dipped into religion. You've seen that, you know, you can see that in my work quite a bit. That's something I might look back at, you know, and kind of experiment again with that. That's something I've dealt with in my life quite a bit. So we'll see. But that's what I'm kind of, yeah, that's something we'll see. I don't know. Stay tuned for that.
Yeah. Hey, now when you're doing your work, I know some people start a piece and will say, well, I'm just going to let it emerge. Whatever's inside the clay that needs to come out will come out. And others, on maybe on the other end of the spectrum, will have specific drawings and ideas and well before their fingers ever touch any clay. And so they're then making what they've thought about ahead of time. Where are you on that continuum?
Yeah. So in school, you know, we were trained to do, you know, preliminary sketches and maquettes and, you know, multiple different size maquettes till we did a life size. And that used to drive me crazy. It drove me crazy. I'm pretty intuitive. You know, I may have an idea. Some of the work, especially the more narrative pieces that tell stories, I probably have that idea in my head. I rarely ever do prelim work. If I have an idea in my head, I kind of know what I want and I'll set out to do it. Most of the single like portraits that you see, that is probably five or six different variations of what you end up seeing. And my wife is usually, she usually steals it out of the studio and stops it at a certain point, because I'll destroy it 10 times. You know, that's a really good one, stop, you know, or, you know, so yeah, it's never, especially in the portraiture, I will keep wrecking it, working it over. So it's not usually set in my head what I'm doing. You know, I don't.
Feeling. It sounds like it's very feeling based.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Like I said, unless I really see something, an image, if I see something out in the world, that's a good idea. I might want to sculpt that.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I don't like to plan things out because it's going to change. You know what I mean? If it's something I've drawn on paper or I've done a maquette, because my work's very loose, when I go to scale it up, it generally doesn't look right at a larger scale. So I end up tearing it up anyway. So to me, that seems like, because of the way I work and it's so loose, and generally my sculptures go so fast, you know, I'm working so quickly. It just seems weird to do these prelim things. So yeah, it's very intuitive, very quick the way I work, and it will change so many different times. Yeah, there's a piece, one of the first heads I did, and I think you can see it online, it's called Albert. It's a big 3 or 4 foot tall head. I mean, that was probably 5 different variations of that. It looked nothing like what you see online when I first started it. I mean, at the end, there's pictures, I think, somewhere, but it was at least 5 or 6 different versions before it even came to the finished piece. So,
yeah. I can see you saying, well, gee, I like that ear. I'm going to hang on to the ear, but yeah. I don't like the nose. And those lips are darn cool. I might add those to the ear, and eventually we get the final version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, tell us a little bit about how you balance the use of color, because you said that was one thing you started to really enjoy with some of the clay work. Like, how do you balance color with design and form and texture? Which may be the ultimate question anyway, but can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, color for me, like I said, which was something that was exciting for me, is one of the toughest parts for me, you know, because I'm not great with color. And then my work is heavy with texture, the way I handle the clay, my tool work and marking. So, I don't use a lot of glaze. So if you look at my work up close, it's just basically all watercolor. I'm not watercolor, but like underglaze washes.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to lose any of the texture. And then it's very difficult to apply the color to the pieces. So you know, while they're colorful, I think, especially in the portrait work, it's basically, I'm just kind of imitating a skin tone. And then a lot of the skin tone I'm adding. So there's the heavy texture line, which is the anatomy. Yeah. So you see like the heavy, in my work, there's like these heavy cheekbones, yeah, you know, usually the hollow cheeks, and then the prominent features, noses and lips and stuff. And then the pockmarky skin texture is the really only glazes that I use are these like kind of crawling glazes over the heavy clay markings.
Yeah.
And then the real color that you see are, like, again, just washes of underglaze. And then the coloration, you know, the colors that I use are usually like, you know, in any kind of the clothing and stuff. So I do like to play with color and colorful colors, I guess, to kind of offset the darkness of the work, maybe, mm-hmm, you know, some of the themes.
Yeah.
And so I consciously, I think that's the bright colors offset the darkness of the work, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the psychological darkness.
Yeah, the psychological pieces. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I see some of the bright colors that you use is really accentuating a part of it, like bright red lips will, you know, bring, yeah, that attention to that piece or that component of the piece itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. To make that right. I mean, they're already bold and like, yeah, you know, exaggerated, but exactly to make those pop even more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. And so mostly you're using underglazes, it sounds like, eh?
You know, again, I didn't have that, you know, that training. You know, I mean, I wasn't, you know, my training wasn't in ceramics, so I didn't have that time, you know, in glaze chemistry. I didn't learn how to do all that. So that came later for me. And so a lot of it was just, again, either figured out on my own or the help of so many great friends in ceramics, and some of the greats, you know, who were so helpful and
yeah,
and just, oh no, try this and do this. And, you know, so it was, you know, I do a limited amount of it. And then again, I don't want to cover, you know, what I do as far as my texture and, mm-hmm, the way I handle the clay. But again, yeah, so it's mostly just underglaze. And then a little bit of some of the crawls and some of the crackle glazes and stuff like that. So it's very simple, you know, what I do.
Yeah, it does allow the form to come to the table. That's really right, what you're trying to get across. Mm-hmm. And the color really then is just used as a way to accentuate the eye so that they can see and experience the form.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think when you look at the new slabs in that show that I just did recently, you know, a lot of the clay is just raw coming through. A lot of it's just black underglaze wash in the, to accentuate the drawing marks in the clay itself, little dashes of color here to, again, like accentuate certain areas. So very little glaze work at all on any of those. You know, so that's something, again, that I might want to look at moving forward to the new work, is maybe some more experimentation with glazes and stuff. Yeah. Moving forward.
I always found glazes a little scary because as soon as you, I mean, yes, you can take them off. I was saying that to somebody the other day and they said, well, yes, Bob, but you can sandblast them off. But mm-hmm, I was going, yes, you can, but I don't want to do that. So right. I like doing what you're doing as well, as finishing things with either a colored slip or an underglaze or something, mm-hmm, to allow the texture of the piece to come through.
Well, we had just had somebody teaching a encaustic class, you know, wax class, mm-hmm, here, mm-hmm, painting. And I said, you know, that's something I've always thought about was, you know, was especially in some of the portraits doing, you know, doing a wax treatment, mm-hmm, was for a finish. So that's something that I want to think about, mm-hmm, in the future is, you know, those kind of finishes. So yeah, something I'll look at.
You know, one of the things that you've mentioned as we've chatted here today is about how important it's been for you to have a community with you and, mm-hmm, to be connecting with other people. Can you, like, I think lots of people that I know end up sitting in their studio all by themselves and feeling kind of lonely doing the work. Can you talk about a good way to connect with a community to so that we can learn faster and better and our work improves?
Well, you know, I think for me, I've always been an administrator. You know, my job has always been administrating, you know, a department, you know, at the Armory in Florida and here at the Halter in Helena and now Omerta, my new business with my partner, Leah Capino. And so I've always been mentoring artists, you know, my whole career. And so, you know, and I love that and I cherish that. It's probably something I'll always cherish and a huge part of, you know, who I am as an artist. But it's in you know, in some ways it's probably held me back a little bit because of the administrative side of it, because I've had to do that as for a living, and that's great, you know, because I think that's so rewarding, is seeing all these artists grow, you know, hundreds probably over all these years, move on, do great things, and that's awesome. And then we all learn from each other. You know, as much as I've taught all these other people, I've learned so much from all of them. And so I think it's huge. You can't just sit in your studio, you know, and expect to grow as an artist. I don't think, you know, and I think what we've started here in Helena is there's so many great artists in Montana and Helena, especially, that don't get the chance to, you know, really get out. You know, they don't have studio space, or, you know, and the winter sets in, they're just kind of stuck, and there's, you know, and so some of them don't even really, they just kind of give up on it. And so what we're doing is we're giving them an experience to come out and either rent a space or work in our common area with us and experience what it is to work in a studio. And so just to see that happen and be creative. And so we feed off that as artists and just helping others. So, you know, to me, that's it just, again, that's what's it's like reignited me now at this point in my career to be back in the studio and think about what's next for me, you know. And so they can watch me, that show that I just did here. They've never seen what it takes to do a full body of work, you know, for a show in 2 or 3 months from start to finish. And so that was a big deal for a lot of them to see that and help in the process, you know, for me to prepare for that show, which was great to have the help.
Yeah.
But it's also teaching them what's involved in that. So I think these community studio situations are huge,
yeah,
you know, for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask you what advice you might have for a budding ceramic artist. And I wonder if that's it, that they should be working within a community.
You know, I think, you know, the way the world's changing, you know, with university and college and, you know, just getting so difficult with, you know, with loans and not being able to afford to do that. I think it's going to happen in the communities. You know, these situations, what we're doing here, you know, I think that's where it's going to happen, you know, is find a local studio and beg to come in and, you know, mop the floors and work in a little corner, you know, and load kilns or do whatever you have to do to learn. You know, and I think that's what you're going to have to do, you know, just whatever it takes to be in a studio atmosphere and learn from whoever's willing to teach. Because I think the ceramic community has always been so open. You know, they want to learn what they know or teach what they know.
Yeah. Very welcoming.
So it's there.
Yeah, for sure.
Very welcome. Always. Yeah. Always have been.
Yeah. And I know up in my community, pottery and ceramics has just skyrocketed, massive waiting lists to get into studios. And so that was a good thing, I think, that COVID did for their ceramics community.
Oh, I think it's the same here. You know, we're our new facility here, we're booked. You know, we're completely, we have no space left. And building owners in Helena downtown are asking us to do the same thing with their empty spaces that we're doing here. Yeah. So the whole thing's growing too fast, and we're trying to, you know, we don't want to say no. It's all these artists that are asking for help, you know, so it's been a crazy year, but we're trying to slowly do this in the right way. And we're working with the Bray and you know, how we can all build a bigger, you know, we have the Clay Guild here in Helena. And so, like you said, COVID, I think, just spiked the interest in pottery and ceramics, and there's a need, and we're just trying to figure out the best way to fill that and get people in here. And
cool.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, I really appreciate you taking this time with me today. It's been awesome meeting you and learning about your process. And I'm pretty excited about seeing what new work comes for you in the next little while.
Well, and I you know, I appreciate you asking me. This has been great. And it's been great meeting you. And I'm excited too to see what I what I come up with here. So
absolutely. Well, let's stay in touch. And for sure. Thanks again. And we'll catch up in the next little while.
Great. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.